Sometimes people ask, why are you so into prophecy? Can't help but be. Between 1/4 and 1/3 of the Bible deals in the area of prophecy. So being a Bible teacher, a Bible student, I have no other recourse than to be into prophecy, since so much of the Scripture is devoted to that subject. And Jesus was into prophecy. The reason I know that is because if you analyze all the answers that he ever gave to questions that were asked of him, the longest answer he ever gave to any given question deals with the signs of the end, or prophecy. Jesus, when he was asked this question concerning the end, man, he was into it. And he shared at great length about it. So in chapter 13, we come to this section of Scripture, which you perhaps by now know is called the Olivet Discourse, paralleled in Matthew 24 and Luke 21. Jesus, of course, had just finished cleansing the temple, overturning the tables, driving out the money changers, the ripoff artists, and then indicting those false religious leaders who were ripping off the people, taking advantage of the people. He had cleansed the temple. He had indicted their false ripoff system. And then he left that area, and his disciples probably felt that he was rather severe. After all, these Pharisees and scribes, wow, they were esteemed highly in the eyes of the people. And Jesus called them snakes and vipers and put them in their place. And so I believe that at this point in verse 1 of chapter 13, as he left the temple, one of his disciples said, "Master, see what manner of stones and what buildings are here." Oh, come on, Lord. Look at the magnificence of this structure, this temple. It's glorious. Indeed, it was. We've talked about the brass gates that went up 130 feet high, stones that were 40 feet long and 20 feet in width or in thickness, cut perfectly to fit right next to each other. Inside, gold everywhere, valued at over $1 trillion by today's standards. A massive building. Without doubt, the greatest single building ever constructed. Master, look at this. Here you've come down on the system, but look around and see its glory. Was Jesus impressed? He said, "Seest thou these great buildings? There shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." In other words, he's saying, in the Greek, big deal. I'm not impressed. This whole thing is going to come crashing down. The size of the temple is beyond your imagining, really. I have stood there at the Wailing Wall, which was simply the foundation stones of that glorious temple. And the foundation towers over you, and the rocks are awesome inside, and the Wailing Wall is so impressive, and that was only a small, tiny little section of the foundation of the temple. Maybe you've seen pictures of the Wailing Wall where devout Jews offer their prayers even to this day, standing against that wall, pressing up against that wall. It's the only part of Solomon's temple, or pardon me, of the temple of Herod, that remains to this day. And that is awesome. And that's only a tiny little fraction of the foundation, which was nothing in comparison to the temple itself. It's a very impressive building. Jesus said it's all going to come crashing down. Indeed, it did. 40 years after he said this, the Romans came down, led by the general Titus, and destroyed the temple and knocked down every single stone. Well, when he said this, he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, verse 3, over against or opposite of the temple. And Peter and James and John and Andrew asked him privately, "Well, tell us, when shall these things be? What shall be the sign when all things shall be fulfilled?" You need to keep in mind here when you study the Olivet Discourse that this, first of all, must be studied contextually. What do you mean? It's four Jewish men asking their Jewish rabbi, when are all these things going to be fulfilled? Not just the destruction of the temple, but when are all things going to be fulfilled, finalized? You must understand when you read this through that it is Jesus, their rabbi, if you would, their teacher, their master, instructing these four Jewish inquirers about the end times. So you need to look at the Olivet Discourse in that context, contextually. Secondly, integratedly. You can never study any part of prophecy without comparing it with other prophecies that have been given previously. In this case, you need to study Daniel. We'll talk about that a little bit later. For Jesus himself made reference to the events that he was speaking of would be unlocked as you study carefully Daniel's prophecies. It is always a dangerous thing, an unwise thing, to take any passage and isolate it from other passages of Scripture which give other information about it. You need to also study it not only integratedly and contextually, but practically. That is, four times in this passage, Jesus says, take heed. The purpose was not to stimulate controversy or to titillate curiosity. The purpose was to awaken them to not be lulled to sleep. Take heed or watch. Over and over again, Jesus said, take heed, watch. Don't fall asleep. Don't get sucked into this world. The temporal baubles, the hobbies, the materialism. Don't get lulled into that kind of mentality, but be watching. So that was the purpose. It was not necessarily to give us understanding in eschatology as much as it is to motivate us to be watching for his coming. And finally, fourthly, you need to see it in context of order to the Jews eschatologically or as it relates to future things. So if you're taking notes, mark this down, please. In this Olivet Discourse, verses 5 through 13 deal with the beginning of the tribulation, the time that is called Jacob's trouble in Jeremiah chapter 30. Specifically called Jacob's trouble, referred to as Daniel's 70th week for you students of prophecy, to emphasize that the tribulation is dealing with Israel and the Jewish people especially. The tribulation does not concern the church, Christians. Why? For the very simple reason that in Daniel's 70 weeks that we've studied previously, 70 weeks or 70 sevens, 490 years are determined upon the nation Israel, the Jews. From the going forth of the commandment to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the coming of the prince shall be 69 sevens or 483 years. 483 years from the going forth to restore and rebuild Jerusalem March 14th, 445 BC, Artaxerxes said to the Jews who were then in captivity in Babylon, go back home, rebuild and restore Jerusalem. So they went back home and did just that. And then you go from that point, March 14th, 445 BC, and you go 483 years out, you come to AD 32, April 9th, the very day that Jesus rode into Jerusalem on the donkey. It was fulfilled to the day. 69 weeks or 69 sevens. A week being a unit of 7 years, not 7 days as we think, but 7 years. 483 days. Amazing. So Jesus comes riding in on the very day that Daniel was given in chapter 9. And that's why he said, oh, if you would have known that this is your day, as he wept over Jerusalem, they should have known that that was the day. But they were lax in studying Bible prophecy, and they didn't realize what was happening. Then, Daniel's prophecy in chapter 9 goes on to say, Messiah then, after he comes, 483 years, 69 weeks, he shall be cut off, destroyed, but not for himself. He's going to be destroyed, but not for himself. Who was he destroyed for? For us. Now that's 69 weeks. Messiah was cut off. The stopwatch stops because Israel rejected Messiah. We now come to the age of the Gentiles. Now Israel rejected Jesus Christ. We come to the age of the church, if you would. That is, all of a sudden now the blessing of God is extended to all people, Jew, Gentile, bond free, no matter who one might be. And we are living in the church age. But there's still 1 week of Daniel left because 70 weeks are determined upon the nation Israel. That 70th week, that 1 week, 7 year period, remember a week is not 7 days, but 7 years, hepsted in the Hebrew. That 1 week, 7 year period is still left, and that, folks, is the time of Jacob's trouble. It's the tribulation. And in that 7 year period, Israel, going through this terrible time of tribulation, trouble, is going to realize there is a God, He has watched out for us, and they are going to get saved during that time. 144,000 Jewish Billy Grahams go throughout the land preaching the gospel. Two witnesses come back. Definitely one will be Elijah, probably the second will be Moses. And they come back and start doing wonders and signs and miracles and preaching. An angel flies across the sky warning people, hey, things are happening. And Israel suddenly, which today is agnostic, will suddenly be awoken in that time, realizing, ho, ho, ho. And Israel shall be saved. Oh, they'll die by the millions. But yet there'll be a revival spiritually that will take place in and through the nation Israel. Now, here's the question. If the church was not in the first 69 weeks of Daniel, because the Lord said through the angel, 70 weeks are determined upon Israel, from the going forth to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah is cut off is 69 weeks or 483 years. The church did not exist in that time. The first 69 weeks, the church did not exist. Only when Messiah was rejected did the church come into being. And if the church was not in the first 69 weeks, how could one say, well, the church is going to be in the 70th week of Daniel? It makes no sense. It's illogical. It's, in my opinion, unbiblical. 70 weeks are determined upon Israel. So wait, if the church isn't in the first 69 weeks and they can't be in the 70th week, this time of tribulation, 7 years, when God pours out His wrath upon a Christ-rejecting world and when suddenly Israel is knocked into some sense, realizing the reality of God and who Messiah really is. Why would people say or suggest that the church is going to be in Daniel's 70th week when God specifically said it's called the time of Jacob's trouble? Jacob is Israel. So where's the church going to be? That's the good news. The church is going to be in heaven, called the rapture. This church age, this gap between the first 69 weeks of Daniel and the 70th week of Daniel, this gap, this parenthesis called the church age, the church is raptured up when the Lord says, come up here. Paul says, wherefore, comfort one another with these words. We shall be caught up, changed in the twinkling of an eye, taken to heaven for a 7-year honeymoon, while here on earth hell is breaking out. Israel is being shaken up, and people have their final opportunity in that time of judgment to acknowledge that Jesus is Lord. Many, many, many will, but most won't. We'll be in heaven, enjoying the Lord, getting our rewards, honeymoon time. Then, at the end of that time, we will come back with our Lord. Behold, Jude said, he comes with 10,000s of his saints. We come back with the Lord as the Lord comes back to rescue Israel at the end of this 7-year tribulation period at a battle called Armageddon. And we come riding back right behind our Lord. Fabulous. So, the Olivet Discourse, keep in mind, 4 Jews were asking about what is going to be the signs of the end. Jesus is talking to Jews and speaking as a Jew, answering their question. So you need to put it in that context. And as I said, the first verses there, verses 5 through 13, deal with the beginning of the tribulation. Verses 14 through 18 deal with the middle of the tribulation, which will be signaled at an event called the Abomination of Desolation, when Antichrist sets himself up in the rebuilt temple and demands to be worshipped as God. And then verses 19 through 27 deal with the end of that tribulation. So Jesus said in verse 5, in answer to these questions that were raised by those Jewish disciples, take heed, verse 5, lest any man deceive you. For many shall come in my name saying, I am. Ego eimi in the Greek, or the name of deity. I am, and Christ is added in most of your versions. And they shall deceive many. Dr. Charles Feinberg, perhaps the greatest Old Testament scholar writing in these days, points out in his excellent work on Daniel, a wonderful brother being converted out of Judaism, but yet being steeped in that tradition, and has much to say about these things, declared that in the first 100 years after Jesus spoke these words, no less than 64 men came on the scene claiming to be Messiah, Christos. And they gained some notoriety. And there was some real sad instances when men would follow these men who claimed to be Messiah as they were led into battle physically to try and overthrow the Romans and were slaughtered mercilessly, brutally. So a number of men came immediately on the scene and said, I am Christ, I am Messiah. Jesus said many would come. And to this day, in these last days, we are seeing a revival of that. I am Christ, Shirley MacLaine declared, as we've talked about previously. We are all Christ. We are all the Christ consciousness. We are all God. Or you have Maharaji Ji. Remember him? The Lord of Heaven in a 747. He had his own 747. And he claimed, you know, this boy wonder at 15 from India in his 747, the Lord of Heaven, comes and teaches basically Hinduism repackaged, and he fills up the Astrodome in Houston. Do you recall those days? It was crazy. Pre-Bhagwan. But in his 747, he began to enjoy something which absolutely infuriated his mother, who traveled with him in the 747. He enjoyed eating burgers and steaks and meat. His mom got so ticked off when he began to become a meat eater. He was supposed to be a vegetarian. He wasn't acting very guru-like, having barbecued burgers. And you might have saw pictures. He got fatter and fatter. The guy, when he first started his thing, he was like those gurus are. He was kind of doe-eyed and skinny and, you know. And then by the time he was 17 or 18, he's this big Buddha-like guy. And flying around in his jet. Finally, his mom got really angry with him when he married one of his staff gals that was 45 years old, and he was only 17 or 18, and he took this, he was supposed to be, you know, never involved with any kind of women or intimacy at all, and he marries this staff gal that's, you know, lots older, and his mom was so ticked that she turned to his brother and said, "You are now the Lord of Heaven." And of course, the movement sort of unraveled at that point. You know, and you still have Bhagwan, and I think I told you about this new guy out of Eugene, Sri Bambi. Sri Bambi says, "Man, give me everything you own." That's his whole thing. Sell everything that you have and give it all to me, because when you have nothing to worry about. That's his creed. People get into this stuff. Jesus said that this would be indicative of the end times. One of the signs will be that men will come on the scene, either claiming to be Christ or that claiming all are Christ. Just visualize peace, man. Visualize your deity. Transcend into a new elevated understanding that you are God and God is you. And let's sit down in the lotus position and chew on alfalfa. Crazy. And you shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. This is going to be happening all the way now. There's going to be men coming on the scene claiming to be Christ or that we all are Christ. You're going to hear of wars and rumors of wars. Indeed, did you know that this week another statistic came out? Maybe you caught it. Every 12 days, the Soviet Union completes a new supersonic bomber. At the very same time, every 12 days, a new supersonic bomber comes out when we have canceled our stealth program, trying to enjoy the peace dividend. But it's not being practiced on all sides. Interesting. In fact, it intrigues me. You might have saw this in Newsweek, Russia and the New Right. How there is a whole new movement in Russia right now to go back to Stalinism. And that is to go back to the days when there is a totally centralized economy and when there is an absolute ironclad rule over the people, back to total dictatorial standards, and it's the fastest growing movement in Russia today, according to Newsweek magazine. The interesting thing about this article, and you can pick it up in Newsweek if you want, but the interesting thing about this article is it points out that the basic movement is steeped not only in a return to hardline Stalinism, but is deeply steeped in anti-Semitism, that the Jewish people are being blamed in Russia for the present difficulties, that they are the architects of perestroika and glasnost, that they have influenced the Kremlin's thinkers and they have caused the mess that Russia is now in economically. No consumer goods available. It's all because of the Jews. And so you come out and you see posters like this in huge rallies inside of Moscow. These posters with the Jewish Star of David and inside a skull, these posters filled with swastikas, a calling for Nazism happening in Russia, 1990, that says, translation, Zionism is a danger to everyone. If we don't take care of the Jews now, they will take care of us later. The implication, of course, being annihilation. There have been more than 500 desecrations of Jewish cemeteries and 1,000 anti-Semitic rallies in Russia in the past year alone. What's happening in Russia is frightening. And it goes on to talk about the incredible outbreaking of Nazi-like anti-Semitism, because when people are in trouble, what do? They have to find a scapegoat. Inevitably, it's the Jew. Why? We'll talk about that in a minute. But there's going to be wars and rumors of wars. It's going to continue happening. In the International Herald, which is a magazine or a newspaper you can pick up on any airplane in any airport if you're traveling internationally, it's the international paper based out of Europe. It talks about NATO ambassadors have been warned by defectors to brace for perilous developments in the Soviet Union, possibly including a civil war between rival armies in the Soviet Union. Providing a sketchy account at closed briefings, the NATO organization sources said Tuesday it was the direst semi-official forecast yet about the outlook for Russia. Perestroika is at an end, said Peter Frank, a Sovietologist at Essex University in Britain. We have to realize that Mr. Gorbachev's situation is crucial, he goes on to say, and he offers a pessimistic overall forecast about the internal prospects for Russia. This was shared by the other two experts, Christopher Donnelly, a British Sovietologist working in NATO, and Philip Peterson, who is the Soviet specialist at the U.S. Defense Department. The discussion included a warning that the decomposition of the Soviet state will bring a potential last-ditch threat from desperate military leaders, the right wing, this movement I showed you about in Newsweek, the fastest-growing movement. And it talks about this fact that Marshal Sergei F. Ashkromiev, or whatever, former Soviet chief of staff of all military, was quoted as having told one Western expert that the Soviet Union has now entered the most dangerous phase of its history since the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution. There's trouble brewing. Wars and rumors of wars. While the Western world is saying peace, peace, there is no peace. In fact, Paul would go on to say that in the last days they shall say peace and safety, but then comes sudden destruction. There shall be wars, and there shall be rumors of wars. Why is this? Could I share with you this? This blows my mind. There is a report published by Leonard Levin on Dial Press, New York, report from Iron Mountain. This is a government report that was leaked, as most government reports are leaked. And this book became a bestseller a couple of years ago. It was a study conducted by 15 scientists representing a wide range of disciplines. The group included a historian, a political theorist, a professor of international law, an economist, a Sovietologist, a sociologist, a cultural anthropologist, a physical chemist, a biochemist, a communications theorist, a systems analyst, a war planner, and a major industrialist. The group was told by the government to waste no time, quote, agonizing over cultural and religious values. It was to give the same kind of treatment to the hypothetical problem of peace, should peace break out, as has been given to the hypothetical problems of war. The conclusion of this blue ribbon panel of our top brains was, If wars would cease if the will to make them cease was there. But since war itself is at the very root of mankind's social system, it is not likely that peace will ever be a serious goal, because no substitute is known which can better stabilize and control national economies than war. War is the foundation of every stable government. Every governing body which has failed to sustain the continuing threat of an external war has lost control of its constituency. War alone provides a nation with the means of controlling potential rebellious youth. It provides society with an effective means of dealing with overpopulation. It is probably the single greatest stimulant to scientific research in any culture. It has a high social value for dissipating boredom. If your culture hasn't a war, you know, on the back burner, it gets bored. It gives the older generation an effective means for controlling a physically stronger and more vigorous younger generation. It's true. I mean, the guys in the Pentagon that make these plans, or in the Kremlin that make their plans, they're not fighting. You know, wouldn't it be radical if the guys that made the plans had to go pull the triggers? I wonder how many wars we would have. The report found no satisfactory substitute for war, although it explored a number of alternatives. Vast increases in social welfare expenditure would not be a sufficient countermeasure. Massive investments in space research would not be an adequate substitute for war for stimulating a national economy. One startling conclusion was that, in the political realm, if war were to be abolished, some sort of slavery would be needed to be instituted as a means of controlling destabilizing social elements. Populations would have to be controlled by the compulsory introduction into water supplies of some sort of chemical birth control. And you might read that RU486. The overall conclusion reached was that war system is essential to society, and it would be irresponsible to remove the war system until it was known exactly what could be put in its place. This is curious to me that our top thinkers say there really cannot be peace, not long term. The world might long for it, but in reality, the industrialists, the politicians, the thinkers, the military strategy men, they realize some factors that war, in their opinion, is a necessary evil. And so generation after generation cries out for peace, but there is no peace. Not until the Prince of Peace, Jesus Christ, comes back. There will be no peace. In fact, the present peace movement, in my opinion, is simply setting the stage for that Russian invasion that we spoke of on Sunday morning. If you weren't here, you might want to get the tape concerning Gorbachev's dilemma today. So, backward nations. Interesting article in the Chronicle from Bulawayo, Zimbabwe. Villagers, scantily clad, trying to rescue a donkey from an earthen dam, dived for cover when they saw what the donkey had trapped in its hind leg, a wooden box containing 100 surface-to-air SAM-6 missiles. I mean, these guys are out there, you know, they're just in their jungle attire, you know, trying to get their things going, and they come across these SAM-6 missiles. Soldiers called to the village near the town to bring out experts who found more Soviet-made missiles after scouring the area, according to Elephant News. I like that. What paper do you get? Elephant News. The missiles were intact and never been used, said Captain Mike Mandagrina, commander of the search party. If it was not for our good donkey, they would still be ready to go off. So, you know, here's these poor people all over the world, in backwards parts of the country's world. Caches, weaponries all over, stored up, ready to go off. And so Jesus said, hey, this is going to be factual. There's going to be wars and rumors of wars, but be not troubled because, verse 7 says, such things must needs be. The end shall not be yet. Don't be blown away by these kinds of things. There's going to be wars and continual preparations and rumors about wars. But, verse 7, you shall hear of, verse 8, pardon me, nation shall rise against nation. Now, I want you to think about that phrase there, because it can equally be interpreted as saying nation shall rise against itself. It speaks of not only nation against nation, but just as accurately, it would be nation will be splitting or warring against themselves internally. We talked about that on Sunday again, the internal struggles in the Soviet Union now. Nations dividing. We see even in a peaceful process, Canada splitting. Nations no longer able to hold it together, but this dividing internally. And kingdom against kingdom. Check this out. In this whole European transformation, did you see the report yesterday that in the election in Romania, having gotten rid of Ceausescu, they had an election to elect a new leader? The turnout, 17% came to the polls. Because it was 17%, it now means that the ruling body will select the prime minister. What's going on? After wanting democracy or fighting for freedom, yet really, there already is the seeds of apathy creeping in, and disillusionment will follow. Because, gang, listen, materialism that will creep in to those newly freed countries is going to be just as corrupting and just as disillusioning as the political repression that they've undergone in the past 40 years. East Germany, as you saw perhaps in Time magazine this week, or 2 weeks ago now with Helmut Kohl on the cover, East Germany is already in shock about the change of morals that have come into their country because now the border is open and the Western influence is coming in. Interesting article about the sociological turmoil, the trauma, in behavior patterns, in entertainment standards, in values that Western Germany, West Germany, has now brought into East Germany, that although they were repressed terribly politically, enslaved politically, yet they were also insulated from the corrupting values of the West morally. And I tell you the truth, when I say to you that they will find in East Europe, all of a sudden with an infusion of Western values, there is going to be a great shock and a repulsion when they understand the kinds of things that we are into in entertainment, in music, in standards of living, it's going to be shocking and difficult for them to transition. And already there are seeds in Eastern Europe of saying, hey, it was terrible under these despotic communist rulers, but man, what's coming in its place? Do we really want this? So, kingdom against kingdom. Will there be a restoration of the kingdoms? Interesting, because when you look at Austria, you have the Otto family. When you look at Romania, you have the Michael family. When you look at Hungary, you have the Habsburg family. These families are monarchies that are waiting to come back into power. It is not inconceivable that in the disillusionment of capitalistic morals and Western decadence, and the rejection of communistic despotism, that they will turn once again to the old monarchies and say to the Habsburg family, the Otto family, hey, we need a king. I find that interesting, that this could literally come to pass, that it will be kingdoms reforming. That's not at all out of line with what the Bible speaks about concerning the kings of Europe coming into prominence and then one taking control or dominance who's known as the Antichrist. Keep your eye on Europe. See what happens there. It's very intriguing because already disillusionment and apathy is creeping into those countries. Already. It's only been, what, a year and a half or what have you. It's already happening. We're trying to unite the world, of course. It's inevitable. You've seen these commercials constantly in all your news magazines. With all of us looking and listening, we are now becoming one world. Time Warner. So it's not just the media that's pressing for one worldism, but you might have seen the new MasterCard commercials. One world, one card. It's a new age. That's what they say. One world, one card. Or, interesting, this is the cover of the Council of Europe, their new poster. It's a picture of Babel. Babel being reconstructed with the stars of the 10 nations round the top. And the whole point of this picture is a restoring of unity to Europe, and they are using as their model the Tower of Babel. This poster you see constantly plastered on European buildings and in European subways. It's the new image, it's the new poster, the new logo being used in Europe, the Tower of Babel, but it's not just in Europe. Photocopied from this, from one of our magazines by Lockheed Corporation, another picture of the Tower of Babel going up. The Tower of Babel and systems integration. The parable is older than writing itself, this commercial for Lockheed goes on to say, coming to us from the first murmurings of civilization. Yet its lesson seems to be aimed specifically at our late 20th century. And it tells a story here in Genesis chapter 11. We read of an unnamed people building a great city on the plain of Shinar, Mesopotamia. To the narrator of this parable, notice they take it as only a parable, not reality. Peering across the time and desert of his own nomadic traditions, these folks were awesomely clever. They all spoke one common language, and because of this, nothing was impossible for them. The plan of these ingenious people was to erect a huge temple tower whose top would reach into heaven. It was to be an altar to their own intellect and would be called Babel, or Gate of God. But God himself came down and walked the streets of their city and saw their project under construction. This arrogant race angered him. He passed his hand over the city and cursed it. Now, where there had been one language, there were suddenly hundreds of languages. Confusion reigned. Nothing was possible. The people abandoned their city and scattered across the land, taking with them their bewildering tongues. And their vaunted temple, the Tower of Babel, was left untopped. The lesson taught by this ancient parable is uncannily present for us today. The revolution in information technology during the past 4 decades has brought with it the ancient curse of Babel. Each year we witness the birth of new computer companies, all fiercely competing with faster, more powerful hardware, new formats, and new languages. All contribute to an atmosphere of discord that the narrator of the biblical parable would have no trouble recognizing. Recognizing this discord, Lockheed has the solution. Good. They are going to solve the Tower of Babel's problem. Systems integration via computer. For years, the company has been synthesizing apparently incompatible systems, whether for use in space, in military, private industry, or government. To this end, Lockheed has been actually able to work against the Babel effect. And with everyone once again speaking the same language, that is Lockheed's computer language, who knows what wonders are ahead. Lockheed, giving shape for things to come. Interesting. Computers, numbers, unifications, common languages, and we will overcome the curse of Babel by uniting together. Lockheed Corporation, Europe itself, the stage is set. You know, I've talked to you previously in years past about the computer system in Brussels, a super Cray computer being used by the European Economic Community, in which every person who lives in Europe is entered into that computer. And that will be the foundation for their entire new euro dollar, euro system. And guess what they call that super cray computer? It's called the beast. The capacity of the beast is not simply large enough to hold those citizens of Europe, but the capacity of the beast will hold 8 billion names. The entire world could conceivably be fit into that large computer in Brussels, super cray computer already in place. Interesting. So Jesus here, in talking about these things, said, now look, here's what's going to be happening. Nation against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and I foresee that as being what we are presently observing. Nations not only vying against each other, but tensions within themselves, internally. Kingdoms, could this mean a return to monarchies, as Daniel spoke of, as Revelation prophesies about? Very possible. Why not? There shall be earthquakes in diverse places. Anybody hear of quakes lately? Man, I'll tell you. I don't know if I brought that in. I didn't bring my earthquake report in. Bummer. That really shakes me up. I'll share it with you some other time. It's phenomenal what has happened in the increase in earthquakes. And I'm not quoting Bible teachers. I'm talking about the U.S. Geological Survey. The intensity of earthquakes and the number of earthquakes on a chart is the proverbial slow slope as you chart the centuries, and suddenly as you come from 1950 to 1990, the curve just goes straight up. It's absolutely phenomenal. And that chart, which if I can find and bring in, it's from the U.S. Geological Survey. It's not, again, some Bible teacher trying to fit something into making it happen. There shall be earthquakes in diverse places. We're seeing that happen right now all over. There shall be famines. Came across an article by Dr. Norman Borlaug, B-O-R-L-A-U-G, which was called the father of the Green Revolution. Now, the Green Revolution that he was the father of is not the Green Movement in Europe today, that new political party. But the Green Revolution of the 1970s and the late 60s was based upon new super strains of wheat and grains that would allow starvation to be obliterated. And these new super strains of grains that were so hopeful turned out to be a heartache because they required great amounts of petrol fertilizers. And as these poor third world countries were given great amounts of grain, along with that came the need for huge amounts of fertilizer. And that led right into the 1973-74 oil crisis. Oil prices quadrupled. They couldn't even fertilize the areas that they had farmed. And Dr. Borlaug recently came out and said the entire project was a nightmare. He says this scientist sees no hope for human life after the year 2000. He is not a believer. He is an agro-scientist who sees that in this country alone, in his report, we are only one drought away from famine in America. We think that we are the land that will be blessed perpetually. We have been blessed greatly, but we have reserves to get us through one half of one drought year. This country could find ourselves in a starvation mode very, very easily. Jesus said, this will be a sign of the end, famines. And we've been reading about famines. You watch it on TV. You're aware of famines around the world. The failure of technology to provide food for the hungry, food for the needy. And troubles. Famines and troubles. Pestilences, as Matthew 24 gives fuller light on that word. Plagues, if you would. Oh, you're aware of what happened this week with the first known case of a dentist passing on the AIDS virus to a person that they were working on. And they're saying now from Atlanta, don't be worried about that. That's the first case. The question is, as we now know, that AIDS takes more than 10 years to usually manifest itself. What does that mean, really? It's the first case discovered. But is there going to be this blew my mind in the Medford Mail Tribune a few weeks ago. from Italy, a 25-year-old Italian soccer player, has contracted the AIDS virus as a result of colliding with another player during a match. Doctors said the two players crashed into each other during a game last December. The virus was transmitted through a small cut to the player's eyebrow and forehead. And so now, you know, I mean, we're going to be reading more and more and more of AIDS being passed on in all kinds of ways. It's a plague. Today's report, or was it yesterday's report, the new figures coming out, which are amazingly underplayed in many people's minds, is now at 10 million infected, known infected people, 25% higher than they projected 1 year ago. We are seeing some tough times. There are plagues. There are troubles. There are difficulties. And Jesus said that this would happen. And then he said, these are the beginning of labor pains. Now, you need to understand this. You say, but John, there's always been earthquakes. Yes, there's always been famines. You're right. There's always been wars and rumors of wars. Exactly. But what Jesus is saying here to these men is, like birth pains, they will increase in frequency and in intensity as you're coming to the end. These things are going to come more frequently and they're going to be more intensive. Like labor pains, something is being birthed. In this case, the birthing is the tribulation period. So you'll hear of wars and rumors of wars and famine. I got to share this with you. This is funny to me. On Earth Day, remember Earth Day a couple of months ago? The president of Physicians for Responsible Medicine, in writing about the famine that is overtaking much of the third world and the prognosis ahead, which is not good. He said, what is the best thing that anyone can do for the earth in these potential famine conditions? He says, have a vegetarian meal. Beef and poultry producers are among the most environmentally unfriendly creatures on the planet. He says that rummaging animals such as cows produce phenomenal amounts of methanol gas, which, he says, is the major contributor to the greenhouse effect, which they claim is leading to the famine conditions that are breaking out in so much of the world. Now, here's what he says. He says, it is hard to imagine the flatulence, that is, the gas, coming from 1 billion cows on Earth. With 1 billion cows, he says the gas produced from those cows, because most of the industrial world are meat eaters and consequently there's too many cows, the gas, he says, is directly responsible for a large degree of the greenhouse effect, the breaking down of the ozone layer. Now, he's the president of Earth Day. Now, this guy's a, you know, he's a doctor. We quote, vegetarians get plenty of protein even without intentionally combining foods or meats. So have spaghetti with tomato sauce instead of meat sauce. Have bean burritos instead of meat tacos. Now that raises a question. You know, what's worse? 1 billion cows or 5 billion bean burrito eaters? I don't know. So, the intensity of these things, famines and plagues and problems and earthquakes and war. Hey, do you realize how intense the next war is going to be, the next nuclear war that will happen inevitably? The Bible speaks of it. I personally hope that we're not here when that takes place. But did you realize that the new weapons that are being built by both the Americans and the Soviets, that every nuclear weapon is at least 100 megatons? Do you know what that means? That is, in one 100 megaton nuclear weapon, that is more explosive power than every bomb and bullet and explosion and mortar that was used by all sides in World War II, including the nuclear explosions of Fat Boy and the two bombs at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You combine all of the bombs and bullets and mortars and hand grenades, all the bombs, including the two that detonated in Japan, and that is less than one 100 megaton bomb, which we are building, until recently, one of these weapons every 20 days. And Russia is at a faster clip than that. It's absolute. If one 100 megaton bomb went off, if it fell in this country, just one, it would wipe out completely the entire state of Ohio. Cleveland, Cincinnati, and all the communities of Ohio would be wiped out from one 100 megaton bomb. And if you were in the area, if somehow you were insulated from the actual explosion, but if you were facing 180 degrees in the general direction of that explosion, you would be instantly blinded. Your eyeballs would melt instantaneously, even if you were 300 miles away. So if you just happen to be facing in a direction where one of these things goes off, if your back isn't to it, even if you're not taken away by it, the very brightness of the explosion will cause immediate blindness, and the heat will cause a melting of the eyeball. Pleasant. Never in history, you see, were these kinds of things possible. When we talked about war in the old days, we weren't talking about this kind of stuff. And that's what Jesus is saying. Like birth pains, it's going to get more intense. It is so frightening that people today don't even want to think about it. People don't even deal with it. This is a sign of the end, Jesus said. Birth pangs, intensity and frequency. Now you know you're on the verge of that tribulation period. But take heed, verse 9. Take heed to yourselves, for they shall deliver you up to councils and synagogues and be beaten. You shall be brought before rulers and kings for my sake, for a testimony against them. And the gospel must be first published among all nations. Now, some say that means that Christians are going to be beaten and go through this time. No, who's he talking to? He's talking to the Jews, and he's speaking of synagogues. How many of you go to synagogue? Not very many of you go to synagogue. He's talking to Jews about their situation in those days, that they will be, when they turn to Jesus Christ, there's going to be tremendous opposition and hostility directed at them. He says then, and the gospel must first be published among all nations. I've been involved in rallies, perhaps you have too. Let's bring Jesus back. Let's spread the gospel. Let's send out missionaries so Jesus can come back, because he can't come back until the gospel is published among all nations. Keep in mind that the rapture of the church could take place today and immediately. You've got 144,000 Jewish Billy Grahams sent out. You've got angels flying across the sky. You have Elijah and perhaps Moses back on the scene. The word is going to get out. I do not believe that Jesus is saying here, I can't take you home. I can't come back. I can't call you up until you evangelize the world. That's not what's being said. He's saying the end is not going to come until every man has heard, be it via satellite or flying angel. Whatever means he wishes to use, it's going to happen in those days. The gospel will be published among all nations. And they shall lead you and deliver you up, and take no thought as they do that what you shall speak. Neither do you premeditate, But whatsoever shall be given to you in that hour, that speak ye. So Jesus here is saying, now when this happens and they bring you up, don't worry about what you shall speak. It'll be given to you by the Holy Ghost. And brother, verse 12, shall betray brother. And father and son, children shall rise up against their parents. And that's going to happen in those days. The system of the beast will be so in place that there'll actually be children betraying their parents if their parents are involved in following Jesus Christ and refusing the mark of the beast. Did you catch the article coming out of Iowa concerning, in light of this 747 crash 2 years ago, there in the Iowa cornfields, that they had terrible time identifying bodies? The one thing that was always left intact, though, were the dentures of people that had dentures. And so now the Iowa legislature last month passed a law that all dentures are to be marked and coded and numbered. And to me, I just think that's interesting. People are already seeing the need to mark people on their body for identification, the mark of the beast. I'm not saying that that is the mark of the beast. I'm saying that there's an acceptance and there's an agreement. Yes, we need to identify people. And this is happening. And those in this time who refuse to take that mark, the mark of the beast, will be betrayed by even their own family and by their friends. But he says, even though you'll be hated of all men, verse 13, for my name's sake, if you endure unto the end, you shall be saved. There's hope. Hang in there. Don't give up in those times of tribulation. If you endure to the end, you shall be saved. Yet, verse 14, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken by Daniel the prophet, standing where it ought not, let him that readeth understand. Then let them that be in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him that is on the housetop not go down, neither enter therein to take anything out of his house, but let him that is in the field not turn back. Woe to them that are with child, to them that give suck in those days. Pray ye that your flight be not in the winter, for in those days shall be affliction, such as was not from the beginning of the creation which God had created unto this time, neither shall be. If you see the abomination of desolation take place, that simply being when Antichrist goes into the rebuilt temple. The temple will be rebuilt. And when it is, Antichrist will go in halfway through the tribulation period, according to Daniel chapter 9, and demand to be worshipped. It's an abomination of desolation. Daniel spoke of it in chapter 11 as well, in talking about another one who committed an act of abomination called the abomination of desolation. In the year 170 BC, before Christ, Antiochus Epiphanes, that madman, who was a picture of Antichrist, who was ruling that area of the Middle East, given authority from the Seleucid family, who was given that position by Alexander the Great, or when he died, he left it to that clan. This man was crazy, and he hated the Jews with a passion. One day, because he was upset that he could not go down and wage war against Ptolemy in Egypt, the Romans, who had moved into the area, said, if you go down there, we'll wipe you out. He was so incensed that he went back into Jerusalem, killed 40,000 Jews in a single day, went into the temple, killed a pig on the altar, put the blood of the pig in the Holy of Holies, and made the priests, at the point of a sword, drink the blood of the pig. It was a terrible desecration. It was an abomination. It was a picture of what Antichrist will do when he sets up his image in the rebuilt temple. Jesus said, when you see that happen, man split for the wilderness, specifically, as we will see later on, the rock city of Petra, a place the Lord has provided to save his people in the time of this outpouring of Antichrist's wrath. Flee, man. But who? Who's he talking to? Again, he says, pray that that day will not come on the Sabbath. Why? Because in Israel to this day, all of the train lines and bus lines and airlines do not function on the Sabbath day. That's not true in America or in Britain or in Europe. He's talking specifically to Jews about their situation, you see. So please, when you read this, don't let anyone fool you into thinking, or not fool you, but lead you into thinking that this is talking to Christians, because Christians, it will not matter if it's on the Sabbath day. To the Orthodox Jew, he will not travel more than several hundred yards. And to the national Jew, he cannot travel very easily because of the nature of the Sabbath principle there intact in Israel. Pray. When you see that happen in Jerusalem, flee to the mountains across the Jordan River to the mountain area of Petra. And verse 20, except the Lord had shortened those days, no flesh should be saved. But for the elect's sake, whom he hath chosen, he has shortened the days. The elect, of course, is a name which is ascribed to three groups of people in the Bible. The Lord in Isaiah said, Israel, mine elect. I've chosen Israel. And he calls them Israel, mine elect. We as Christians are also called the elect of God. And also the tribulation saints, those that are saved during the tribulation period. People that remember times like this and might not respond today, but will remember when it comes down, they are also referred to in Revelation as being the elect. So Israel, the church, and the tribulation converts, they're all called the elect. And here, except the time was shortened, man, nobody would survive those days. And if any man, verse 21, shall say to you, lo, here is Christ, or he is there, believe him not, for false Christs and false prophets shall arise, shall show signs and wonders to seduce, if it were possible, even the elect. But take heed, behold, I have told you all these things. In those days, many will come, even in the tribulation time, declaring that they are the second coming of Christ. Don't be fooled. In these days, don't be fooled when somebody says that Jesus Christ has already come back and appeared in Brooklyn to the Watchtower Society. He's in a secret place, a secret chamber. He's here, he's there. Wrong. When he comes back, it'll be obvious to all. But in those days, verse 24, after the tribulation, the sun shall be darkened, the moon shall not give her light, the stars of heaven shall fall, the powers that are in heaven shall be shaken. And then shall they see, who every man shall see, the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power, with great glory. Then he shall send his angels and gather together his elect from the four winds, from the uttermost part of the earth to the uttermost part of heaven. I believe the elect speaking here is, spoken of here is Israel. All Jews will be brought home at this time. Right now, sad to say, more Jews are leaving Israel than are entering Israel. Jews are going into Israel from Eastern Europe, from Russia, with the idea of getting out of Israel and going to New York. And so the Jews are still, by their own choice, for the most part, dispersing themselves. It's a great concern in Israel right now. But in this time, they're all going to be gathered up and brought home, as now the kingdom is being set up. The tribulation is coming to a close. When will these things be? Now suddenly in verse 28, Jesus, having talked about that, the beginning, the middle, the end of the tribulation, now, new paragraph, now, he goes on to say, you ask me a question about when is going to be the end of the age, and I talked to you about the tribulation. And now he says, changing subjects a bit, learn a parable from the fig tree, the national symbol of Israel. When her branch is yet tender and putteth forth her leaves, you know that summer is near. So in like manner, when you see these things come to pass, know that it is nigh even at the very doors. What come to pass? The blossoming of the fig tree. What is the fig tree? It is Israel. It's my strong conviction that what Jesus is introducing here now, he said, I've answered your question about where things are flowing to, the tribulation, the troubles in Jerusalem. The birth pangs intensifying. The persecutions for those that take a stand for me in those days. Now, he says, now, learn this parable. The budding of the fig tree, that is the birthing, the re-blossoming of the nation Israel. May 1948, a miracle took place. You've heard me talk about it much. You're aware of it. The only time in history when a nation has come back from the dead, exactly as prophesied by Isaiah, Ezekiel, Zechariah, and a host of others. The fig tree has blossomed, and Jesus says that the generation that sees that shall not pass away till all these things are done. I understand that to mean very definitely that we who saw the budding of the fig tree are the final generation. It is in our generation that Jesus Christ will rapture the church, which will bring in the tribulation for those that are left behind here on earth, and then followed by the second coming when we come back with Jesus as he establishes his millennial thousand-year kingdom. Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my words shall not pass away. Could I say this real quickly? As we approach the year 2000, it has tremendous significance, I believe. Tremendous significance. Biblical records seem to indicate, as Bishop Usher points out, if you have a Schofield or other kind of study Bible, that Adam and Eve were probably on the scene 4004 B.C. Or 6,000 years ago. We are now approaching the year 2000 A.D. Interesting, because 6 is the number of man. We are coming now to the end of that number of man. We have had our time. We are headed now for the 7,000th year when we get to the year 2000. The 7th millennium. 7 is the number of what in the Bible? Sabbath. Rest. The Shabbat. And that's what the millennium is going to be. A Sabbath. A rest. No more war. No more disease as such. No more man striving. No more is man ruling. No more is man reigning. Now it's the rest, for Jesus Christ comes back. And in that 7th millennium, for 1,000 years, there shall be peace and rest and Sabbath. But then at the end of the 1,000 years comes what? A final rebellion. Satan leads one more rebellion. And then at the end of that, when he is put down, this earth and even heaven itself is destroyed, and a new heaven and a new earth, which have never been affected or polluted by Satan or by sin, is going to be put into place in the 8th millennium. What is 8 the number of scripturally? New beginnings. We're coming to the end of the week. The 6th day is just about up. We go into Shabbat real soon. I do not believe it is appropriate or possible to set days and hours. When that book came out a couple of years ago, was given to me, I talked to you about it then, 88 Reasons Why Christ Must Come Back in 1988. A date was set. I'm going to write a book, One Reason Why He Didn't. No man knows the day or the hour. And by setting the day or the hour, and people bought into that book, and I guess now he's got a new book coming out. 90 Reasons. That's what I hear. I don't know. You can't set the day. But, Paul said, of the times and the seasons, you must not be ignorant. We can't know the day or the hour, but we should know the times and the seasons. And that is important, that you are aware. Jesus gave us a very simple, very significant parable, the fig tree. When you see that blossom, man, you are the final generation. My coming is nigh, even at the very door. You can know the times and seasons as you see basically the full plan of what God is doing in each millennium historically. And we could go into that further, but I won't right now. I'll just say that it's a flow that you can follow through if you wish on your own study. Every number matches up amazingly. We're headed for that seventh millennium. The millennium. And then the new beginnings to follow. Now of that day and hour, verse 32, no man know, not the angels which are in heaven, neither the Son, but the Father. Take heed, watch, pray, for you know not what the time is. For the Son of Man is as a man taking a far journey, who left his house and gave authority to his servants, and to every man his work, and commanded the porter to watch. Watch therefore. For you know not when the master of the house comes, at evening or midnight or at the cock crowing or in the morning, lest coming suddenly he find you sleeping. And that I say unto you, I say unto all, watch. One final comment. Watch for what? The coming of the master. Please, listen. If you are watching for Antichrist, you're watching for the wrong person. Those who embrace a post-trib position, saying the church is going to go through the tribulation period, they are not watching for Jesus Christ, they are watching for Antichrist. Jesus never, ever said to watch for Antichrist. He said, watch for Him, the Master. You watch for light, you don't focus in on the dark. Don't be taken up in this idea, well, we're going through the tribulation, so I'm going to store my rice and my beans and my oats and buy a gun, and if anybody tries to break in my garage, I'm going to blast them. I'm going to be ready for the tribulation. I've got my freeze-dried food. I've got my bottled water. And man, you try to take it from me and you're dead, dude. That's real Jesus-like. You know, isn't that, can you see Jesus teaching that, saying, now here's what you should do. Store your food, your water. If anybody tries to come and take some to survive, kill them. That post-trib survivalist rap, I feel, is crazy. It's insanity. Because if you're preparing for the tribulation so that you and your kids can survive, you are going to be forced to kill people. Because word is going to get out in those days that you've got supplies. And if you read Revelation 6 through 19, which describes those times, it's going to be so awful that people will do whatever it takes to survive. And what are you going to say? You either will be like Jesus Christ and give to those who ask, in which case your supplies will last about, 35 seconds, or you'll kill them. Jesus never taught us to prepare for the tribulation. He taught us to watch for His appearance, to keep awake. Keep in perspective. In everything you do, keep in perspective. Today could be the time. Oh yeah, but that leads to weakness if you're looking for Jesus. We got to get tough, man. I've heard that so often. We got to get tough and get trained for the tribulation. The Apostle John, in speaking about His coming in 1 John chapter 3, said, oh, whoever has this hope of Jesus coming, the rapture, purifies himself. Even as He is pure. If you really believe that Jesus Christ could very well and may very well come back tonight, How many of you are going to go out to Manhattan Rose and boogie or get drunk or snort crack or whatever it might be? You won't do that. If we believe that Jesus' coming is imminent, it's going to have a tremendous purifying effect on our lives. It's going to have a comforting effect, even as Paul said, comfort each other with these words. Watch for Jesus Christ. That's the blessed hope. Jesus would then also say, it's the evil servant who says, my Lord delays his coming. I believe it is a great error for any servant of God to say, Jesus cannot come back. We have at least 7 more years to go. There's still a delay necessary. I do not believe that is in the spirit of what Jesus was teaching on the Olivet Discourse. Watch, he said. Keep awake. Take heed. Be alert. Don't let anyone say it can't happen today. It could. And if it does, it's fine by me. Let's stand, shall we? You've been very patient. We've covered some ground tonight as far as prophecy goes, and I appreciate your patience with me. But as we go our way, please understand that there in chapter 10 of the Apocalypse, John was told to eat the scroll which speaks of that title deed of the earth. All the prophecies of Revelation center around who's going to control the earth. And it says, I ate that scroll, and it was like honey in my mouth, but it was bitterness in my belly. That's what prophecy really does. When you first hear of that hope, oh Lord, you mean you might come back and every problem solved, every bill taken care of, everything righted, everything wonderful that could happen? Oh, that's great. That's sweet. I love the taste of that. But if prophecy really is digested by you properly, if it sinks in deeply, it will cause a bitterness in your belly. Oh, the promises are sweet. But the implications are bitter in the sense that your family, those that are not believing in Christ Jesus, are headed for hell on earth. We'll be in heaven, but they'll be in the tribulation. And if they don't get saved then, they're headed for eternal damnation. It means that your kids, if they're not walking with the Lord, if you've been neglecting discipling them or introducing them to Christ, they're headed for tough times. It means your neighbors, the people you work with, your mom, whoever it might be. See, prophecy is not something which just sort of, oh, that's interesting. But if you really are digesting it, it will move you to a new intensity for evangelizing, a new intensity of interceding, a new proper prioritizing of your time. It moves you, your stomach, man. You realize, oh Lord, I'm saved, I'm going to heaven far out, but what does that mean to the people I care about? And my prayer is that in my life and in your life, that as we talk about prophecy and give study to prophecy, that it might be sweet in our mouths, but that we might digest it and it might rumble in our stomachs and move us into ministry, move us to evangelize, move us to say, you know, I've got a responsibility to bring people to hear the gospel, to share with them at work, to pray for them day and night, It's not a game. It's not a theory. This is fact and reality. So may it stir in your spiritual belly and move you and motivate you to a new level of ministry in these last days. In Jesus' name, amen.